Okay, the question, Rabbi, that I would like to ask you, where you said that the Cohen had a, he was the scholar, so he called him the Lord your God.
Right.
But he goes down and he talks about the Lord who swore unto our fathers to give us.
Yeah,
so he's right. Identifying with the same God.
Same God, yeah.
Okay. Right. But he just said, you're saying that the Cohen has a superior knowledge.
That's correct.
Okay, a superior knowledge
superior
to the
knowledge.
To the normal man out there, because he's spending 50 weeks a year studying, and the guy that's coming up is not spending that time studying.
That's right.
Okay, all right.
Okay.
I'm clear then. Thank
you. Okay. So here we see how the Torah demands that when the person recognize the fact that the scholar, the man that studies Torah on a full-time basis, this person has a greater knowledge of God than the person who doesn't, who is ignorant. Okay? Now, it's interesting. Take a look at Jeremiah 10:7. Jeremiah 10:7 makes a very interesting statement. In 10:6, he speaks about that there is no one like God. He says, you are great, and your name is great and powerful. Then in verse 7, he says, who does not fear you, O King of the nations? Because that is appropriate for you to be feared, in other words. And then he says, because among all the wise men of the nations and all their kingdoms, they all say that there is none like you. Okay? I don't know what your translation is, but that's it's an elliptical statement. There's one problem there, and I just supplied what is missing. So it says because among all the wise men of the nations and in all their kingdom are you. But that, of course, is nonsensical. Obviously, no human being can compare to God. But as an elliptical statement, what it means is because among all the wise men of the nations and in all their kingdom, they all say that there is none like you. Which fits into exactly what he was saying before. So I don't know which way you have it in your translation, but that's the proper translation. Now, the question is, he's speaking about all the nations. Now, Jeremiah was a monotheist. Jeremiah was a prophet. Jeremiah was a very great learned person. And as a matter of fact, he was a Kohen. He was a priest also, as you know, and he says that everyone fears God. Oh, that's wonderful. Everyone fears God, then the Torah's work is done. What does he mean when he says, everyone, who does not fear you, King of the nations? Okay? What does he mean? What he means is that, you see, the other nations also recognize the one God. The only, and I mentioned this many times before, that the Egyptians recognized one God, but they worshipped sub-deities. What Judaism taught the world is that there are no sub-deities, and worship must be done exclusively to the one God in the manner that he directs through prophecy. That's what Judaism taught people. Not that there is one God. There are many primitive people that recognize one God. If I'm not mistaken, I think even the American Indians recognize one God, one spirit in the universe. But their service was always to the sub-deities. People make a mistake when they think that the Torah taught the idea of one God. The idea of one God was worship of one God, was never known until Torah. The worship was always worship of sub-deities. That's where the primitivism was. So what Jeremiah says is, your name is great among the nations. Everyone recognizes the one God. Now, what it means is like this, you see. This is what you have to understand. That recognition of God takes place on many levels. Many levels. And that's what the Torah is saying. When you come to the Kohen, he is the one you must admit that your recognition of God is on a primitive level compared to his recognition of God. He has a different insight into God. But your concept of God is not zero, it's not nothing, okay? there is, even on a, even in the primitive person, if he recognizes there's one force, he has some idea, even if he thinks that this force, even if he thinks that this force is physical. But okay, that's wrong. That's absolutely wrong, and that's a major violation in Torah. But there is a nuclear, there's a nucleus of some idea of a cause behind everything he sees, you see? So, but of course, that idea is very vague, it's obscured, it's tainted, it's contaminated. But there is something there. What the Torah demands of the person that comes before the Kohen is that he has to recognize that. He has to say, God, you're God. You have the clear, the clearer, the more clear idea, the more precise idea. It's an idea far advanced. It's an idea based upon knowledge. Mine is a lower level, an emotional idea. People say, you know, I was speaking with David this week, David mentioned a point which got me thinking, and as a matter of fact, as I was driving home, I was thinking about it. And I didn't have an answer at the time, but I believe now that I do have an answer. David mentioned to me, he says, you'll notice among the Torah, he says many times, he notices that they don't speak about God. There's no talk of God. And, you know, I mentioned that, of course, it's impossible to construe a Torah without God, and, you know, I was thinking about why it's a... But you see, let me explain to you. I think it's not a defect. I think it is actually, it shows you the holiness of the people. And that is like this. People always, other religions, they always speak about God because they think they know God, you see. On a primitive level, their primitive idea of God, they are secure and they're certain and they're sure that they know God. So they're always talking about God. But Torah teaches a person, just a moment, your idea of God, you may think you knew God when you were 10 years old, or when you were 5 years old, or 6 years old. But that wasn't really a knowledge of God. That was just a very, very primitive idea. That idea was very contaminated. When you grow older and you study, and the more knowledge of Torah one gains, the more his idea of God becomes purified, rarefied. It's different. The scholar's idea of God is different than the average person, because Torah is knowledge. And in all knowledge, a person reaches closer and closer to God. If he doesn't, then there's something wrong. Then there's something wrong in the process, you see. But if the process goes on normally, then his idea of God has to evolve, change, undergoes change.
Rabbi?
Yes.
All right. Is that another airplane going over?
Another airplane we got there.
Okay, all right. Well, this is not New Hampshire for sure.
That's for sure.
All right. See, I would... say that a person, say 5 or 6 or 7, 10 years old,
right,
that their idea and concept of God is in direct proportion to the knowledge they possess.
That's correct.
And but then they can only relate,
right,
on the level that they understand.
That's
so
correct.
As they get older and the reasoning faculties,
right,
and
that's
the
correct
rational and their and being able to rationalize things, then they can enter to a higher level of understanding of God.
That's correct.
But a person has to, and say, I would not say that his ideas are primitive. They would be, say, you or a Rabbi Soloveitchi or a Rambam,
right,
definitely a Moses.
Right.
But his idea of God might be superior to any other 5-year-old or 10-year-old or 13-year-old.
Without a question.
So,
there's no question. I am in full agreement with you. I didn't mean primitive in terms of, I didn't mean it derogatorily. I meant, when I said primitive, I didn't mean derogatorily.
Okay,
I meant as you said it, and comparatively.
Okay, all right. Okay, all right.
Okay?
Okay, that's where we get. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Now, what I would like to say is that this is one of the important, really important principles of Torah. Namely, that we recognize this concept, that in Torah, as a person increases his knowledge, he increases his knowledge of God. It goes hand in hand. This is different, far different, a different concept, the concept that that basically other religions were never able to grasp. As a matter of fact, the basic dogma of Christianity is that that the scholarship has nothing to do with the with knowledge of God, but rather who will enter into heaven is not dependent on scholarship. It's dependent on belief, not his knowledge. This is completely diametrically opposed to Torah. In Torah, as a person increases in knowledge, he increases in his closeness to God, in his closeness to God. As a matter of fact, Descartes, the philosopher Descartes, was raised and studied in a Jesuit college, and of course he was a brilliant person. He's the father of modern mathematics and modern philosophy. And what he was taught in college, in the Jesuit college, was that that the way to heaven is not less open to the most ignorant than to the most learned. You see? And that the revealed truths which lead to heaven are above our comprehension. That's the philosophy of Christianity. Torah is diametrically opposed. In Torah, the more knowledge of Torah you have, the closer you are to God, your idea of God is closer. A person can never really approach God with a positive idea. I'm not going to have a separate discussion. But the fact is that the more a person studies, the greater the scholar, the greater his knowledge of Torah, the greater is his knowledge of God, and the closer he is to God. And it's very interesting. See, you'll notice that the Torah really took this whole thing with the first fruits and made a whole issue out of it. It caused the man to come to Jerusalem. It caused him to go before the Kohen, before the priest. It caused him to make these statements to talk about, tell the whole story of the history of Egypt and going out of Egypt and the miracles and the fact that he came to this land. Why did the Torah take this commandment, this mitzvah, and elaborate so much when there are so many other mitzvahs that you just do them? For instance, giving the Kohen it's not tithes, it's called truma, okay, or giving the Levite his tithes. There's no ceremoniousness. Over here, there is a whole formula. A formula. He has to give this whole speech. Why did the Torah do it in this case? Now here is where Maimonides comes in. Maimonides explains that when you study the primitive idolaters, you find that the first fruits are something around which all kinds of ceremonials and fertility rites and primitive rituals abounded. So I just saw recently a show where they showed an echo of how the primitive tribes, they still have it today actually, they believe that the earth is the powers of the earth bring forth the fruits and the different powers in the earth. And this, of course, is primitivism, is idolatry. Now, the Torah never goes against the instincts. And the same thing with the religious instinct. The Torah recognizes that religious instinct is the most dangerous, because idolatry is unbridled religious instinct. But the Torah works with man and tries to take his instinctual and direct it towards Torah and towards the one true God. So what does the Torah do? The first fruits are a very exciting thing. The earth's the product of the earth, of one's toil, of this. Now, 1 second, plane. And the excitement and the fears that the earth will not produce, the dangers, famine. This is man's whole life depends on the on food. And therefore, the primitive people always had these rites surrounding the first fruits. The Torah says, the Torah makes sure that this doesn't happen. So what does it say? The Torah says, take the first fruit. Where do you take it? You take it to the temple. Who's in the temple? The Kohen. Who is the Kohen? The Kohen is a scholar. He's a person that has knowledge, as it says in Deuteronomy. He does both. He serves and he teaches. because you deserve to do performances without any knowledge is worthless in the eyes of God. So the Kohen must be, it was intended that the Kohen, the man who does the service in the temple, should understand the service, should understand Torah, should have a higher understanding of God. Then when the pilgrim comes, the plain person comes to him, he can be sure that he will not act in any primitive way. The first thing he must do when he sees the Kohen, he must admit and mention, God, your God, you have a greater knowledge of God. You can identify, your concept of God is greater than mine. Okay? He is your God. I submit to your knowledge. I recognize that you have a superior knowledge. And he takes these first fruits, and what does he do? And he recites a whole story about the first fruits. First of all, he says the land was sworn to not because of me, but because of our fathers, because of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then he says, and he goes through the whole story about the fact that he was taken out of Egypt, and the fact that God. And you take a look. Take a look at verse 9, 26:9. And he brought us to this, gave us this land. Why the emphasis? The emphasis is that the person should never think that the land is anything special. The land doesn't produce fruit. This land doesn't have any magical powers. No, nothing special about the land. God brought us to this land, to this place, and he gave us this land, a wonderful land. It's a bountiful land. It's a good land. But it's all from God. He is the only, he's the only source. There is no other source. There's nothing magical about the land, nothing special about the land. It's just that God knew that we needed a land. He brought us to this place. You'll notice that he brought us to this place. He brought us to this place implies there's a practicality involved. We have to have a land. He gave us this land. He brought us to this place. And he gave us this land, and it's a wonderful land. But there's nothing special about the land. The special is that God gave us this place to live. And therefore, he says, and now I brought the first fruits. Take a look. He says, which you, God, have given me. Who is the one that is beneficent is God, okay? And then he places it before God, and he bows down before God, and then he rejoices with the fact that God has benefited him, okay? This is where the Torah takes the emotions that a person might have, misguided emotions that would cause primitive idolatrous practices, and raises them to the highest level. But you'll notice it begins with a recognition of the fact that the scholar, the one that has knowledge, has a greater idea, a more correct idea of God, closer, different idea than he does. That, and there again, I said, as I mentioned last, the Torah recognizes that the greatest danger is each person thinking that each person alone thinking that he has. Okay, excuse me. Each person thinking alone to himself that he has the inside track to God. He can feel that it's not based on knowledge. See, knowledge is universal. Knowledge is not something that a person can keep to himself. Feelings are specific, are individual. When a person maintains he's superior because he has a holy feeling, he's holy, no one can argue that. I mean, and this is, it's not an objective thing. Everybody, yeah, I'm holy, I'm close to God. Why? Because I feel that way. But you feel that way, and millions of other people feel that way as well. This is something which stems from man's megalomania, his egomania, that he thinks he wants to insist on the fact that he's special, he's God's chosen. No. That's not correct in the Torah. Chosen, what's chosen? A person who has knowledge is the one that has knowledge is the one that is closer to God. And he can't hoard the knowledge for himself. He can't be God's favorite. There's no such thing. There is only, God's system is objective. It's based upon knowledge. The one that has knowledge is the one that is close to God, is the one that has the correct idea of God insofar as man is capable of achieving such an idea. And that's what the pilgrim has to say at that moment when he brings the first fruit, to remove himself from any traces of primitivism. That's what the Torah does. The beauty and the greatness of Torah is how it takes man, it doesn't deny the instinct, it doesn't deny the primitive instinct. recognizes it. I mean, you have to meet the person, and this is something we say constantly. And it's something that David has, has incorporated in his practice, to meet the person where he is. The Torah recognizes the person's emotion. It wants to be honest with his emotions. It doesn't want him to deny emotions. Be honest with him. But it channels it away from the root of to disaster, and channels it to the root of Torah and knowledge. And this is a beautiful example in this particular commandment of how beautifully it's formulated, and how it teaches the person the correct idea of God. And when he walks away from the temple, he walks away with a totally different knowledge. Even though he may not have gained in terms of study, but it's a different awareness. And that awareness should lead to an involvement in study and pursuit of knowledge. And that's the way, that's the direction that's how the Torah guides a person. So again, I just wanted to point out that the archenemy of the Torah is when people think that on their own, their own imaginings, that they're close to God. It is simply part of man's sick ego that he wants to be God's favorite. Everybody wants to, that's an emotion which is counterproductive, which causes the person to get involved in fantasy and actually takes them away from God. And here's where you see how the Torah actually, again, recognizes the danger of such an idea. That's what I wanted to bring to your attention. I just felt there was an opportunity since we're involved in that, so I continued a little bit with the digression. But what I'd like to do is, if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer the questions. If not, I'll start my road back to the Talmud that we were doing. So I leave it to you at this point.
All right, Jeff has got a question. All right, Jeff. All right, the statement in verse 9, the land for many.
Right.
That's an idiomatic statement.
Yes.
Okay, so explain that to him.
The land that flows with milk and honey is an expression. It's used several times in the Bible. It just means a wonderful land. By the way, the honey doesn't mean bee honey. Okay, there's certain things that you have to. It's funny, you know, when we see certain terms in the Torah and in the Tanakh, we immediately think of something that we're familiar with, but it's not necessarily correct. Over here, because of when it's about the honey, it means that they used to make date honey, because it comes from the land, okay? And so the honey over here is not referring to bee honey. As a matter of fact, that was one of the questions in Talmud: how do you know you're permitted to eat bee honey? Because it comes from insect, which is non-kosher, and anything which comes from something which is non-kosher is prohibited to eat. So there, the Talmud explains that the bee doesn't really produce the honey. He takes the nectar from the flowers, and he's involved in the process through adding enzymes to it. But that's not considered. It's not actually considered a part of his. It's not his body. It's not part of his body. The honey's not flowing from him, from the bee. That's why it's miserable. But this, but Talmud says, why don't I use this verse where it says honey? Talmud says, no, that's referring to the. To the honey that comes from the one of the seven things grow in Israel, which is the dates. But it's an expression. It just means to say it's a beautiful land. It's a land which gives forth its produce, productive one. As a matter of fact, when they complain to Moses, so they use that expression. They said, "You didn't take us to a land of that flows of milk and honey." Okay, so it's an expression. But over here, that's why they mention it over here is, again, because what he's trying to say is it is a wonderful land. There's nothing, it's wonderful. God gave us this land. It is a wonderful land. He wants to appreciate the fact that it's wonderful, but not to think that it has some magical powers. It's because God gave it to us. It's a wonderful land, God gave it to us. But it all stems from God. But there's nothing special, magical about the land. You know very well that you remember the tribes when they entered into the land. So 2.5 tribes took land on the other side of the Jordan. They didn't. They said that we have sheep, and they told Moses. They said, "Well, you know, we don't. We'd rather stay here." And that is Moses agreed, and you see this, and now that that part of Israel, that's also part of that also has a law of being a part of the land of Israel. But the land of Israel is not a according to Allah, actually, any area that is under the sovereignty of the nation of Israel becomes a part of Israel. Okay? So again, you see how the halacha removes any kind of magical attachment to the to a specific land.
Okay. I mean, Rabbi, you got 60 seconds.
Okay. All right. It could be even Italy. It could be anywhere. It could be any country in the world. If it's under the sovereignty of the only thing is that you're not permitted. You're not permitted to take any land before you have the land which is designated in the Torah. Okay. Any other question?
I think I'll take care of us, and rather than getting to the end of it, see, this can come under the law of the one God.
Okay.
So this is still the Talmudic end of it.
Okay.
So we'll begin there next week.